Monster Man, bonus episode, More Dragon Magazine.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
But today's episode is a special episode for my patrons at all levels. I know that I've been a little slack putting out this bonus content that goes to everyone who subscribes to my Patreon, but if there's one upside to being in lockdown, I suppose it's that I have a little more time for things like this, and I'm starting to catch up on my backlog. So today, I thought we would continue the project that I've been doing of going through some old Dragon magazines. And when last we left, we were looking at Dragon magazine number 155. I'm using the UK numbering, so I actually don't know if the contents are different. And we were looking before at an article about the fairy folk. But that's not the only article about monsters in this issue. We already looked at the article, The Folk of the Fairy Kingdom. I do want to just quickly jump in and take a look at the very end of that article, because we talked about the different kinds of creatures from boggarts and bacons to swan maze and sylphs that appear in this article, but that also ends by introducing a new deity as a fairy queen, and this is Rhiannon, the queen of fairies. And in something that was, I think, relatively common for Dragon magazine, but doesn't exist in Deities and Demigods, is this second edition yet? We get some special abilities for druids who are dedicated to the queen of fairies. So for example, they can turn animals, they get some different proficiencies, and so on. As for the description of the deity herself, she is an indescribably beautiful elven creature with a pair of gossamer wings. Woodland creatures flutter around her. Her flowing hair changes colors with the season, so that's kind of neat. So it's red in the fall and white in the winter, and so on. She's kind of an interesting deity in that she will grant a wish sometimes to mortals who stumble across her, particularly young women. But other than that, she's not that exciting. The problem with deities like this, and it's not necessarily a problem, but if I asked you to sit down and write me a description of the Queen of the Fairies as a deity for AD&D, Rhiannon is pretty much what you would produce. And as the game kind of strives to be this definitive, you know, the standard of fantasy role-playing game, it does have this problem where sometimes it becomes very, it can be a little bit generic. Other games, because they're in a sense in dialogue with AD&D, have the ability to provide the hot take, to do something that is contrary to your expectations, but because D&D is the norm, it seldom does anything really weird. And that's what you get here with the fairies. They're very much what you would expect. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but arguably it's a little bit limiting. And arguably it's slightly redundant. Other than the mechanical aspect of it, Rhiannon's description here doesn't really provide anything that I would not have, like, thought of myself. But this is far from the end of the fairy and elf content in this issue. We get an article about the Grugach, the wild elves, who we've talked about before. My favorite thing about this article, and I'm not saying it's a bad article, but my favorite thing about it is that it has a full-page Janet Alesio illustration, and you know I like some Janet Alesio, which makes the Grugach look kind of moody and sinister, which is supposed to be what they are, that they're kind of poor and remote. You know, they live in hard areas to live in. They're isolated from other cultures, and as a result, they're kind of suspicious of outsiders. There isn't much difference between this presentation of the Grugach and the presentation in Monster Manual 2, where they appeared. It's more kind of, like, justifying why they're such jerks. So we've seen the Grugach as being, like, hostile and xenophobic, and this has sort of been a response, I think, to the nicening of elves. You know, that elves who are meant to be these mysterious creatures become familiar and friendly, and therefore the Grugach are introduced as kind of like, well, wood elves, but sort of with the dark wildness that you maybe wanted from your wood elves but weren't getting. And they're described as, says the gray elves have a poetic term for their kin, children of the eldest elves, referring to their resemblance to the earliest known ancestors of all elves, which is to say that they're kind of primitive. And it does have a good description of them. It says that they're hunters, not fighters. They're not a society that's sufficiently complex that it really has an army. And again, that kind of ties into the idea that they are, as a culture, relatively poor. So they make efficient use of kills. You know, they don't have the luxury of spending the money or the resources to have full-time fighters. What they have are hunters and, you know, other people who kind of like defend their community as part of the network of scouts and stuff that you get when you have like hunters and shepherds out there. Yeah, and again, there's a nice idea. It says Grugach warriors usually belong to intertribal secret societies, which are quasi-religious in nature. And these societies help prevent warfare between Grugach tribes because members of a warrior society are forbidden to fight one another. Now, there's one thing that I don't like here, which is that it describes real-world society, real-world, like, human cultures that have these initiatory warrior societies or other kinds of adulthood initiation rites as primitive, which I'm not fully on board with. Because what this reminds me of is the idea of the warrior societies within Plains Native American tribes, the most famous of whom, of course, are the Dog Soldiers, but there are many other ones. Now, these were mostly within particular nations, but might operate between bands, I'm not sure. And they were initiatory lodges that played an important political role within Native American nations, and which had display, you know, which were given certain privileges in times of war, and which often had certain rituals that actually are pretty cool and dramatic from a pure outsider's perspective. So one example, for instance, is that warriors of some of the warrior societies would wear a long sash, and in the heat of battle, they would have like the honor of guarding a retreat. And to do that, you drop your sash. The sash is very long so that its end trails on the ground, and you stick a knife through the foot of it and pin your sash to the ground, resolving not to move from that spot. And only another member of your society has the right to take the knife back out. Someone else from your society is the only person who can tell you to retreat. I think it's a really cool image, and one that maybe doesn't fit the Grugach, but is a good thing to take for another kind of warlike organization. It's a good little rite. So a pretty cool little article about the Grugach. Again, I don't know that there's anything super standout about it. There's some more additions to the Elven pantheon. I don't want to go into it. There's Areleth Letheranil, and there's Kirith Sotheril, the goddess of magic. And I'm sorry. I know I should care more, but I my views on this pantheon are well known. Then we've got the Snow Elves. I don't necessarily want to go into a huge amount of detail about them. They sort of, you know, hassle Viking types, and they are, you know, secretive and remote, and a bit like the Grugach, but for the blinding whiteness of the tundra rather than the deep woods. And here they're presented, I think, primarily as a player character race. And finally, we have an article by Gordon Mingus, or possibly Menzies, about the ecology of the satyr. Like other ecology articles, this is primarily told in an in-universe fictional narrative. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I do think that it's it has some aspects of the discussion of, you know, love and relationships that we've come to see in these kinds of articles, where the sort of like the voice's attempt to sound sophisticated comes off sounding really weird. A satyr is born as the male child of a satyr and a dryad. If they are a female child, they'll be a dryad. And if they're a male, they'll be a satyr. That's the impression I get. And they seek out their father's band and live with them. And it goes on to say, although satyrs frequently enjoy the company of females from other races, especially lonely human shepherdesses, for some reason the incidents of half-satyrs are extremely rare. This is good, for the typical satyr attempts to woo just about every female he meets. Obviously, given the male-dominated society satyrs live in with no positive feminine influence save for those first years, they're always gruff, masculine creatures. They hide their true emotions, although they tend to be quite outgoing. Satyrs don't understand male-female love beyond its physical aspect, and marriage is a totally alien concept to them. They are forever bachelors. No satyr could hope to restrain himself from the charms of a new female that happens along. If I have to hear female in that context one more time, you know, like, we're not talking about stick insects. Like, you can say woman. Again, I get it, which is that they're trying to present this information as if it's being, you know, as if it's in a sort of like an ecology textbook or something like that. And if you were discussing animals, you absolutely would say, you know, a male and a female, unless there was some kind of specific term. But it just comes out really weird. It just sounds like one of those, you know what I mean? You can hear the voice going, females. It doesn't come off right. Now, maybe that's the distance of time. Of course. And it then goes on to say, because of the way that satyrs respond differently to men and women, this means that, for example, like if a male spellcaster charms a satyr, the satyr will immediately attempt to engage him in some kind of like literal headbutting dominance competition, because that is how he understands a friendly relationship between males takes place, right? Like, I'm treating you like a close friend, like a member of my satyr band. And in a satyr band, we establish the band's hierarchy by headbutting. Superficially, this feels dishonest, but I feel like there's actually something to be said for it. I do like the idea that, you know, charm person makes that person like you, but you don't really know what that means to that person. As long as you play fair with it and allow characters who kind of apply some anthropological knowledge to understand how that spell's going to work, I think it's okay. However, failed saves against a female spellcaster means the satyr will be even more obnoxious in his attempt to woo her. Here, the satyr will become the jealous lover, keeping all males away from his true love. And he gets bonuses on attack rolls when fighting his alleged rivals. And the lovesick creature will go to great lengths for his lady and will generally be as great a pain in the neck as possible. Here I kind of like it, because I love the idea that what it does is makes the satyr fall in love with the caster, but in kind of this, like, doofy romantic comedy way, and not in the other way that you would normally associate with the idea of a satyr. I can kind of get on board with that. Like, they will actually go around doing tasks for you, but all while irritatingly professing to be your true love. Obviously, there are some older attitudes on display here where, you know, we see that the idea of romantic love is specifically described as, you know, only possible between men and women. You know, a topic where TSR's presentation has frequently been criticized, and where TSR, I believe at one point, had quite explicit guidelines saying that it couldn't, you know, discuss same-sex relationships. But I feel like overall, maybe apart from some kind of awkwardness in the presentation, this article actually threads the needle pretty reasonably on keeping the satyr a sexual being, which is fundamental to the satyr's myth, while keeping that sexuality mostly within the realm of tasteful tabletop play, right? Like, where it is presented as, you know, essentially a farce rather than any of the darker places that I might have gone to. So overall, pretty pleased with the ecology of the satyr, which I was expecting not to be a big fan of. That's all for this bonus episode. In our next episode, we're going to move on to Dragon Magazine number 160, and we're going to look at gibbering mouthers. Yeah, we're going to look at the ecology of the gibbering mouther. That probably won't take as long. So if there is time, we're going to move on and take a look at Dragon Magazine issue number 164, and we're going to take a look at the Iron Cobra. Once again, thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon. I hope that you enjoyed this bonus episode, and hopefully the next one should be out pretty shortly, rather than, you know, I think it was, you know, a month or two ago that I put out the last one. So sorry about that, but hopefully we should now be back on a somewhat more regular schedule. So that's all going to be next time on a special patron-only episode of Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.